Honorable Commissioners, I'm Dr. Melanek. I'm an assistant medical examiner with the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner. On April 11th, I came and spoke at the Ethics Commission regarding the SIA for the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner. At the time, I alerted you that our employees were being told by the Chief Medical Examiner to disregard subpoenas and that they needed to stop their private practice work because it conflicted with their duties for the OCME. I informed you that this was a violation of past practice, impeded our ability to provide for our families, and it suppressed our ability to testify even pro bono in cases of public concern. The Commission acknowledged our concerns and withdrew its draft response because the letter did not address the problems the SIA created. Chairman Herr directed staff to instruct the department head to address our concerns. To date, a month has passed, and we have had informal meetings with Dr. Hart and Interim City Administrator Amy Brown. We have presented them with a preferred language for the SIA. Administrator Brown has not instructed Dr. Hart to change the SIA, and on May 3, 2011, Dr. Hart told us that she's not going to change the SIA without written instructions. Dr. Hart has met with us on several occasions to discuss the language of the SIA, but she still insists that private practice consult work is a conflict of interest for the city and interferes with our official duties. There are no grounds for this. And meanwhile, we continue to get referred consultations that are being denied using the matrix from your withdrawn draft letter. Last week, the Napa County Public Defender requested that I consult with him on a criminal case where the death occurred in Napa County and the autopsy was done by a pathologist on contract with the Napa County Coroner's Office. Dr. Hart used the matrix in your withdrawn draft letter and denied the AWD because of the potential that my involvement in the case would cause problems with Napa County. The denial is attached. This makes no sense. I have worked for other Bay Area counties' public defenders in the past, and previous testimony never created any problems for our office or for the city. If the Napa County public defender needs a local expert in forensic pathology to review the work of another pathologist, then for the sake of justice, he should have the right to hire me. I should also have the right to work for him and testify, even pro bono. Restricting my ability to testify on my own time is an infringement on free speech under the First Amendment, and it's also bad government, since it denies the public defender the ability to offer the best defense for his client. I have reasons to believe the SIA process is being used to single me out because I complained last month. I request you advise Interim Administrator Amy Brown to reverse this AWD because it is not a conflict of interest for the City and County of San Francisco. Furthermore, the professionals, not just me, but the other assistant medical examiners, investigators, and toxicologists at the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner implore you to change the SIA yourselves or direct the Chief Medical Examiner in writing to revise the SIA to state the following. No officer or employee of the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner may engage in testimony as a retained expert consultant in a case where the death occurred under the jurisdiction of the City and County of San Francisco or where the City and County of San Francisco is a named party in the lawsuit. This wording would be consistent with past practice and would remove the unfair and now punitive AWD process. I'm also submitting a letter from Dr. Venus Azar. She's another assistant medical examiner. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Commissioner. Speaking as an anonymous citizen, of course. Stop the corporate rape of the public library. Don't give money to Friends and Foundation. Don't accept money from the Friends and Foundation. Is there a time limit on my comments? Okay, thank you very much. Actually, the last time I was here, I think we talked about the need for a timer that people could see. I brought my own stopwatch, but that really shouldn't be necessary. I thought the commission agreed with my comments at that time. Since I only come here intermittently, I want to tell you that I've been doing some thinking about what ethics means since the last time I was here. And of course, reduced to its essence, ethics means that the rules apply to the people you know as well as the people you don't know. This is the classic formulation of the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Even strangers. And this is also the essence of what we used to call social values. The idea that in a democracy or in a society that we were trying to form in this country, people had an investment at whatever class, at whatever social level, they had an investment in society which would not be demeaned because of that social class or economic status or whatever. And these come to us as the kind of bedrock of what we call American values. Now, people very often will, and I hear it all the time, people will say, I don't care how other people are treated. I've got friends. I've got money. And, of course, no one can afford not to care how other people are treated. Because unless we're a corporation, we're all just human beings to somebody, and we're all strangers to somebody. Now, I make these comments in the hope that what we call the Jewel Gomez complaint will be coming up very soon. But, of course, these issues apply across the board. It shouldn't depend on status or people's connections or networking or anything else. The rules have to apply across the board if we're going to have a society that is really decent, really democratic, and really applies everyone. And the reason should be obvious. If we give status to our friends, too often those friends have bought that friendship. And you hear it in society, in City Hall now. People will stand up in a board of supervisors, being supervisors themselves, and say, well, for the City Hall family. Well, it's not the City Hall family. It's society, and we should all be a family. Thank you very much.
My name is Richard Hansen. I want to make it very clear that I'm here as a private citizen. I'm not getting paid to be here, and I'm not representing any other group. Last week, I read some of the accounts in the newspapers about the, can we call it this, the Snow Lake fiasco. It was in Rachel Gordon's article in the Examiner. It was a rather long article in the North Side and also the Marina Times about the arrangements made in selection of a contractor to work at Snow Lake. Also in recent months, there's been some consternation about how the development contractors were selected at Treasure Island and at Hunter's Point. And I don't know where the big flurry of support for the Americans Cup race came from. But you had a lady speak about that last week. And if it works out, you know, that's good for the Oracle Company and maybe for the city, but that could be a boondoggle, the same as Treasure Island threatens to be. Well, I had occasion to go to the Commonwealth Club last week and just mentioned this to Acting Mayor Lee and said that I felt there was a lack of transparency in some of these things. And especially I was concerned to learn from the newspaper that some of the people who spoke at the Snow Lake hearings with Parks Commission and also for the selection group and the Board of Supervisors were getting paid $500 for testifying. Now, all I know is what I read in the newspaper, but according to testimony being presented in a court, the interested party made arrangements through a lobbyist that there would be up to 45 people at the hearing, and the lobbyist would provide the questions to be the statements that he would give in his or her 2 or 3 minutes. He was given a script to read from, and that the members of the board would be given questions to ask, and the individual who was testifying would be told how to answer them, and he would be told where to sit way up front. To me, that's a terrible distortion of the democratic system. And my goodness, this seems like a buyout. This seems like a shell. Is everybody in the world a paid lobbyist? what I suggested to Mayor Lee, and I got to say that he was there at 7 o'clock at night, and he was anxious to go home and eat, and it was a long meeting, so he didn't have a chance to think about it very much. But I guess he has a background as a whistleblower, and he said that he thought that that problem was taken care of, that in the city hall, lobbyists are identified. Well, the only way I didn't know how to identify a lobbyist is they're very well dressed, and they have shiny shoes, and they tend to wear a necktie, sir, and a vest, and they really look good. I mean, they're not uncouth. They don't look like anybody I ever met on the Muni. But what I would like to suggest for your consideration, because I hope the Ethics Commission proceeds on this, I think this deserves the Ethics Commission consideration. Following up what Following up what Mayor Lee said to me, is that every lobbyist would be properly identified. Well, facetiously, one thing I thought of was making them wear a little Pinocchio nose, you know, because I'm getting paid to be here, and I may lie to you. The other thing is they could have a appropriate medallion. This happens. I happen to have this because I gave money to the food bank, and an appropriate envelope, and on the envelope would say how much this individual is getting paid to address the city officials for 2 or 3 minutes. You know, like it would say, I'm being paid $500 or $45
to speak, sir,
on the final subject.
Yes,
but make it transparent.
Yes.
Make it transparent so everybody knows. Transparent.
Thank you for your comments,
sir.
Your time is up.
Thank you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Paul Currier. I'm a candidate for mayor in the year 2011, and I have a public comment. Well, it should be brief. In opposition to accepting the minutes for the April 11th meeting as published, as drafted. My point in showing up this late notice is a number of us that are candidates in the race for mayor this year are not necessarily informed of all the goings on back and forth in City Hall. One of my main issues is the corruption and the obstruction of justice that goes on within this House of the people. And this is the Ethics Commission. It's absolutely critical that all of you remember your fiduciary duty to the voters of the city and county of San Francisco, the people that I'm speaking for right now. The contract that was offered by the Board of Supervisors and given to the now appointed Mayor Ed Lee to guarantee his right to return, or that there would be a deal worked out so that he could return back to his old job. This violates San Francisco's ethics, especially if a mayor is making decisions on contracts of multi-hundred-million-dollar proportions. We're dealing with a $300, possibly $400 million deficit. We're looking at deficits moving forward at $300, $500. Maybe as much as $1 billion within the next 5 to 10 years. So the idea that a mayor can return from the office, chief executive officer position of the city, to city administrator, where they're now in charge of a whole staff that's approving and denying business relationships between the city and county and private industry, this is absolutely anathema to good ethics. And that's my comment. Thank you.
Any other public comment? As a reminder to those who provided comment, the commission cannot address issues that are not on the agenda at today's meeting, but we appreciate all your comments. The next item on the agenda is proposed amendments to the Statement of Incompatible Activities for the San Francisco Public Library. Mr. St. Croix, would you like to introduce this? Ms. Ng?
Yes. There is a memo that sets forth the reasons why the public library wishes to amend its SIA. Essentially, what staff believes is that several of the provisions that were adopted regarding the SIA of the public library apparently do not work anymore. And what staff wants to say is that the SIA should really not be set in stone. If we learn of changes and we learn that some of the provisions are unduly restricting employees in their pursuit of outside activities, activities that really do not constitute incompatible activities, the commission should seriously consider changing them. There is the deputy city librarian here, Jill Bourne, who is here to answer questions that you may have, and I'd be happy to answer any questions as well.
Mr. Dorn, did you have any comments, or would you just like to answer questions?
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Jill Bourne, Deputy City Librarian. I think for the sake of your time, I'm happy to answer questions.
Okay. Commissioners? Commissioner Luke?
So I have a question. Have there been requests for advance written determinations? Has that process been shepherded, I suppose, or attempted?
Yes, although not as many as we would expect. So we've had one request for advance written determination. And I think that the fact that the tool wasn't being utilized was one of our concerns, in that we felt that it had a chilling factor on some of the activities of staff. And we actually learned that in implementing the statement in the current language, some decisions had been made by units of the library to do things such as cancel an exhibit that had been planned at the library through an outside organization, because it was discovered that there was a staff member with a connection to that organization. So there was actually a public service impact. And so one of the things that we sought to do was make the advance written determination increase awareness of that as a tool to staff. And we've talked about that as part of these conversations.
And how long has that been since the increased awareness?
Well, so we started conversations with staff about making revisions. We didn't originally intend to propose striking sections. We wanted to try to tweak the language to allow what we saw as appropriate activities, but still prohibit inappropriate activities. And that started in 2009. And actually, we came up with different versions. We worked closely with the ethics staff and the city attorney, and I thank them for all their support in understanding this process, because all of the administration in place now wasn't here when it was originally proposed. So as part of those conversations, we increased awareness about the advance written determination, but to your question, I found out as recently as last month that there were still staff that weren't aware of it. So one of our goals is that if we have edits to the new version, is to do a full-on sort of both communication strategy, but also engage with staff so that we have a document we can all really believe in and make sure people understand it and know how to use it.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
What happened to that one AWD request?
It was very recent, actually, and it's being approved.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Other questions for Ms. Bourne?
Yes. I understand the position that you feel that the conflict of interest provisions will take care of general concerns if you strike the language that was proposed to be eliminated. What I didn't find specifically in the conflict language was a notion of separation of a person involved from decisions like the decision to purchase books from somebody who publishes his or her writings, or choosing an exhibit or a training program that the person might participate in. But I think that probably is elsewhere. It wasn't cited back to us. So how do you feel that separation is taken care of if we go ahead and do what you've requested?
Yes, I'm really glad that you brought that up, because another part that we learned through working with ethics staff was that we could add other documents to the statement, and we do have a very detailed collection plan and a collection policy that is adopted through our Library Commission. We also have exhibits plan and policy. We also have a Library Bill of Rights and other guiding principles that actually really, and a privacy policy that really dictates how the library makes decisions around things like collection development. So while we felt the provisions in there that restrict inappropriate activities, like a person trying to make sure we buy copies of the book, that really wouldn't happen, because we have a very detailed collection plan that dictates how we spend our resources. Thank you for asking.
But along those lines, presumably somebody has discretion to make selections. And there's nothing in here that I've seen that limits the ability of that person to solicit a publishing contract, you know, with the very entity that is providing those services to the library.
Well, selection is actually done by many, many people across the library, and part of that collection plan is that every area of the library is selected through committee. So there is a lot of checks and balances, and then there is an administrative team that manages the spending of collection dollars. So you could also see when, you know, if we're buying too much from one publisher, one vendor, you know, that, those sorts of things. And the decisions about numbers of copies and that sort of thing are all determined through that plan and that process. That said, I think the other provisions where our concerns were misuse of library resources, time, not representing the library outside in an inappropriate way, and that's covered. And I think that that's where we think that a person potentially using their position to solicit a publishing contract is actually prohibited by some of the other language in the full statement of the statement of incompatible activities. I don't know if Mabel can comment on that.
Yeah, if I can just add, all officers and employees are also subject to the Political Reform Act, and under the Political Reform Act, you really cannot engage in a governmental decision if you have a financial interest in that decision. And a financial interest is something like if you receive, for instance, $500 from a source of income, if you receive a gift of $420 or more, or you have an investment of $2,000 or more. If you have those types of financial interests, you are prohibited from engaging in governmental decisions regarding those sources. So I think that would cover a lot of the issues that may come up.
But the SIA covers it.
The
SIA. Why would we eliminate the SIA?
No, the SIA talks about outside incompatible activities. The SIA also references the other laws that all officers or employees are subject to, such as the Political Reform Act. So even though you have the Political Reform Act, you have the SIA to tell you those types of outside activities that you should not engage in because, for instance, they're subject to review by the department. For instance, for us at the Ethics Commission, because we regulate folks who run for office in San Francisco, we may not be engaged in any of those types of activities because we actually regulate that area. So what I'm saying is that the SIA really, I mean, to the extent that there's a template that covers all city departments, there are also certain specific provisions that apply to specific departments that tell you what activities are incompatible or in conflict with their actual duties. Does that answer or?
Well, that is an answer, but I'm not convinced. I can't imagine that we would eliminate the statements of incompatible activities where now someone who is responsible for making decisions in connection with a vendor is moonlighting for a vendor who is being paid to work on the weekends or work in off hours. So I could accept some version of this, but I certainly couldn't accept a blanket deletion of the SIA so that anybody who's working there, whether they were making decisions about retaining a vendor or not, is being paid by a vendor. I mean, that's the way graft works.
That's not how I understood this, the effect of this, the sort of layers that are operating in this situation. What I understood was that what we have in the provisions that they propose to delete are universal restrictions on anybody who works at the library. If I reshelve books so that I can eat, so that I can write my poetry, I'm not allowed to get a contract to publish my poetry book, even though I am miles away from the decision about what's acquired, right, that I would not be able to sell that poetry book to any publisher. And that as for the person who does make the decision about poetry acquisitions, that that person cannot participate in buying his or her own book or from his or her own publisher because of the broad citywide restrictions about conflict of interest.
But that's,
so where are you seeing a space? Because you're usually
the
right.
Person
so what's
who,
the whole?
So it's not about it's not about whether or not they buy my book. It's whether or not I'm being paid to have them buy any book that I publish. So that's the point.
I'm not understanding your.
So the SIA as it currently reads, my understanding is that no employee could be employed on their free time mm-hmm. by a vendor that is doing business with the library, mm-hmm. which covers your
poetry reshelver,
right? Shelving, but it also covers the whoever the purchasing agent is on behalf of the of the library could be being paid to work for a publishing company that the library buys books from.
Not under the conflict restrictions that apply to everybody in the city.
But the general conflict of interest is not, it's using your position to influence decision making. It's not prohibiting maybe the steps that might lead to someone to get in a position to abuse their power.
That's why we have the SIAs.
I thought what Ms. Singh was saying was that it would cover, in other words, someone who had purchasing authority
could not
be employed
by that
same vendor and get paid more than $500 a year. That's just flat out prohibited. So you wouldn't, in other words, that provision covers the situation you're worried about, so the SIA doesn't have to. The SIA is broader and currently covers all employees, including the example that you all have been discussing. But if we removed it, we don't have to worry about the problem of the person with purchasing authority because that's covered by a different provision in the Political Reform Act.
Which begs the question, why do we have SIAs for any department then if there is a place that covers these, quote, conflict of interest?
Because there's other behavior that we think is special to the agency that goes beyond the conflicts rules. I thought Ms. Eng's example was a good one. Even if we thought that somebody working for the Ethics Commission would not fit the paid by or the other conflicts, specific ones, we think it wouldn't look good to have the receptionist run for the Board of Supervisors. That's just a choice you make when you work for the Ethics Commission. You cannot run for office during that time. That's different from the conflicts rules, which don't touch anything like that, and it actually takes away a very important right from the receptionist that is part of what we think you have to have for this agency.
The general conflict of interest rules really govern financial activity. It says that you cannot make a governmental decision if you have a financial interest somewhere else related to that governmental interest. So you cannot do that. What the SIAs do is go beyond that and say and talk about things that are in the government code section that was adopted by voters, and this a lot of the SIAs, they deal with use of city resources. You cannot use city resources for a non-city purpose. You cannot be paid by anybody else for doing your city job. Those kinds of provisions that do not appear in the general overall Political Reform Act conflict of interest, they don't appear there. The SIA contains those provisions that we think are important. Your use of time when you're in the office, not engaging in political activity while you're at work. Those types of provisions. That's why we have the SIA.
So do I have a financial interest if I'm a city purchasing agent? Do I have a financial interest in a decision that I make to use a particular vendor?
You
Go ahead.
To use a particular vendor where that particular transaction doesn't pay me anything, but that I work for this vendor, I'm a consultant for this vendor on other matters.
Yes, you do have a financial interest, and that would conflict you out from making a governmental decision. Yes. If you receive $500 or more for your consulting job for that vendor, no matter what area you do that consulting work in, you have a financial interest. You may have a conflict of interest, and that conflict of interest will prevent you from making governmental decisions regarding that specific vendor.
I don't mean to nitpick, but you said I may. Either I will.
You probably will.
Not probably. Do I or don't I?
Ah, come on.
Yeah, I mean, we're looking at thresholds, yes. And then the answer is, in your particular instance, the answer is yes. There are some specific narrow exceptions. Like, for instance, if you were the governor and you had to make the decision, an exception may apply. That's just telling you, conflict of interest really depends on the specific facts before you. But there are general parameters. The general parameters is if you have a gift of $420 or more from a source, if you receive $500 or more, if you have an investment of $2,000 or more, you cannot engage in governmental decisions regarding those sources. You're conflicted out. Okay?
And is there a requirement in that government decision-making that you disclose that? You disclose that you have this financial interest with this vendor as to this decision that you're making?
Yes, there is. There is in local law that requires you to disclose that either in, if it's an open meeting, in the minutes or in the file. Yeah.
I just wanted to comment that this conversation was a lot like our conversations with Ethnix, is that originally our intent was to just revise the language to allow for things like the page who publishes a book or, you know, that sort of thing. But then in working with the staff, it turned out we were sort of nitpicking and twisting the language to the point where it seemed like it was becoming too hard to understand or meaningless, and that everything we were trying to prevent was prevented through the rest of the statement or through other legislation.
I guess my other question, unless the commissioners have other questions, was the example that's provided here in the memo seems pretty predictable given the language.
Which one?
So, for example,
which one?
I'm looking on page 3 of the memo. The librarian in the arts reference section has a personal passion for dance and has published 2 monographs on the subject.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to me, that is the natural, obvious consequence of A. So, what is it that you found was unusual or that didn't meet your original expectations that leads you to now think this needs an amendment? In other words, obviously the Library Commission found this was appropriate when you first implemented it. Now you don't, because the very thing that the rule calls for has come into existence. So I guess I'm looking for what changed or what was unexpected about how the SIA would be implemented that now leads you to want to change it.
Well, I think what changed really is that the Library Commission is completely different than it was at the time, and the Library Administration is different. And we've been trying to piece back to 2004 when it was actually discussed before the previous Library Commission. And I think that what we've discovered is that there wasn't a whole lot of staff engagement during that time. And so when these became sort of relevant to the current administration, it was very clear that there were conflicts of this sort and that it's prohibiting perfectly reasonable activities. So in this case, the publishing is the most obvious one. I think the ones that were less obvious was that the idea of staff who are artists in the community, or we have a staff member who lives in an artist co-op, and actually part of their residence there requires that they participate in art projects. And so there are a lot of artist entities there, and so it actually would prohibit any of those entities from exhibiting work in any public library in San Francisco, whether they're being compensated or not. So there were other examples in the other categories that I think were less evident to us, but when we started to go through each one, there were examples in each one that we felt needed to be addressed.
Okay. Commissioners, any other questions for Ms. Warren? Any other comments or further deliberations before we take public comment?
Would you like a motion before you take comment or not?
I was thinking not.
Okay, that's fine.
Public comment on this matter.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Speaking as an honest citizen, of course, and stop the corporate rape of the public library. Don't give money to Friends and Foundation. Don't accept money from Friends and Foundation. And if anybody wants to borrow my stopwatch, I'm glad to offer it. As has been intimated, the Library Commission approved a statement of incompatible activities on July 15, 2004. It's not withdrawn, superseded, or amended that statement since that time. The version that the Library Commission approved in July 15 of 2004 is not either the old version or the new version that's being presented to you. Just as a simple matter of due process, there might be any number of people who are concerned about these issues and follow the Library Commission agendas, but not the Ethics Commission agendas, who might want to weigh in as part of public deliberation on what kind of statement of incompatible activities the library should have. So before you take this up, I think you should ask that the Library Commission be asked to weigh in. Second, the library is the quintessential example of the nightmare of incompatible activities. For years, well, let's start at the beginning. There was a city librarian who was city librarian for only 6 months, and the Friends and Foundation gave him $5,000 when his term ended. I pointed that out to the Civil Service Commission. Civil Service Commission pointed it out to the district attorney, and the district attorney actually sent a very strongly worded letter. There was a chief of the Maine who implemented a digital project to digitize resources, and then was hired by the company that was doing the digitization. For years, the head of the library got $800 a year. They called it coffee money, and the chiefs and coordinators got $400, again, coffee money. And of course, this comes from a private nonprofit that uses the facilities of the library as if it's their own, conducting all kinds of fundraising and non-fundraising and influence peddling activities that needs to be addressed to make sure that we've really got a democratic institution that's free of these kinds of activities. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, commissioners. My name is Andrea Grimes. I'm a special collections librarian at the San Francisco Public Library. I work on the sixth floor of the main library in the Book Arts and Special Collections Center. I'm also an officer in the Librarians Guild, which is a chapter of the SEIU Local 1021. Yes, the original document, the original SIA document, was approved by the Library Commission in 2004. But the library staff members, as far as I understand, did not have adequate or appropriate input until now. So the document that you see before you has been carefully worked on with the cooperation of everyone in the library, including the library administration, the library staff members, and the union. So I'm here to represent the union, and I want to let you know that we have had a long bond of trust with our public. Through our shared ethics and shared values, library workers work with and for the public good. We do not work for ourselves. One document that I would like to have added to the revised SIA is our code of ethics, which is promulgated by the American Library Association. And just as physicians have their code of ethics, in which first do no harm, so do we have our code of ethics. Significant in the code of ethics for the the American Library Association, which, by the way, was first put together and passed in 1939. So it's a very old document that has passed through many revisions, the most recent being 2008. Number, which hopefully this number will answer some of your questions, and that's number six. We do not advance private interests at the expense of library users, colleagues, and our employing institutions. So that covers a lot of ground. It's further amplified and supplemented by the ACRL Code of Professional Ethics for Special Collections Librarians, which I am a member of and adhere to. That is on our library webpage that you can see at any time. What I'd like to do is just give you a copy of the Code of Ethics of the American Library Association, which we are asking be placed in the currently revised document. And I am here to say to you that we are very pleased to support the document as proposed by the Library Administration. Thank you.
David Philpell, good evening. The issue before you, as I understand it, is amending the SIA for the library. I wanted to speak in support of the changes that are proposed with a couple of minor tweaks. I've already mentioned this to staff, where reference in the draft refers to SFPL. In at least the first instance, I would spell out San Francisco Public Library. I have no objection to including the ALA Code of Ethics as an additional reference. My understanding is that the referenced SFPL policies are on their website and prominently located there. I would suggest that the ALA code either be there or that a link be placed there so that all of these additional separate and special reference policies and plans be available so that if anyone wants to refer to them, they're very easy to find. But otherwise, I think that these changes make sense. I think to provide some additional historical context, this whole SIA project related in part to issues at the Department of Building Inspection and some other things going on around town. And I think out of an abundance of caution, as former Supervisor Peskin used to like to say all the time, there was an interest in including a lot of specifics in departments to give examples whether or not they were needed, and if in the fullness of time it proves that not all of them are needed and are covered by other sections, I think it does make sense to simplify and remove them to the extent that they're already covered elsewhere. So I hope that helps, and unless I can be of further assistance, thanks very much.
I have a question actually for you, Mr.
Sure.
I mean, what indication do you have that that it's no longer needed? I guess, what evidence of that have you seen?
Well, from what I understand from the library's presentation and the materials I've reviewed, that they really have some legitimate concerns, and where there's a source of income from the artist living situation or someone who has published a book but is not involved in collections decisions, I think there isn't, to me, a concern of undue influence or an incompatible activity that, or an activity that should be deemed incompatible. If there's a particular provision that's being violated where someone is receiving funds or is a decision maker on collection activities where there really is a conflict problem that would exist under other law, that's already prohibited and covered in that way. So the somewhat unique situations that the library has articulated, I think, give good reasons for excluding that language from their particular SIA. And I'm not being paid to say this. I want, never mind. Thank you.
Yeah, I have a question, and it may be for the library staff. What's the role, or for Ms. Eng, what's the role of the Library Commission, if any, in the review of these changes?
When the commission considered the SIAs, it was determined that approval by various commissions was not necessary. So for the SIA of the public library, even though they approved it in July of 2004, it was not submitted to the Ethics Commission until August of 2004. And from 2004 until they were finally adopted in 2008, there were very, very many changes to the SIA because we adopted a template, because we engaged in meet and confer with the various unions. So throughout that process, as one of the gentlemen said, the version that was approved by the Library Commission in 2004 is not the same version that we have today. It's very different. And when this issue came up with other commissions during the Ethics Commission's consideration of the SIA, what we stressed was that the law does not require commissions to approve the SIA. What the law does require is the Ethics Commission to approve the SIA. What we could do here is that if the commission decides to initially approve this SIA, we go to meet and confer with the unions, and at the same time, the draft version of this could also be presented to the Library Commission so that they are at least apprised of the developments in this area.
If I could comment as well, we've talked about this, and that actually is our intent, is that because the commission is new in most respects, we weren't sure what direction we would get from the Ethics Commission, and so we wanted to come to you to see if we were in the right direction and then go to our Library Commission to get their feedback as well during the period between the final approval.
Ms. Bourne, I have another question for you.
Yes.
Are any of these instances that you've found going as you've reviewed the process, have any of them involved officers of the library?
And by that you mean the Library Commission?
Yes.
No.
Oh, okay. So I mean, for example,
or the library.
The city librarian.
City librarian.
No.
Right. Okay. So if this were restricted to officers, would you have a problem with that? But removed employees?
I would probably want to think about it, but off the top of my head, the intent was to revise the language for employees.
Because
we've also discussed whether there are other restrictions that should be added that are around the area of purchasing specifically, because that's not a case in which we, you know, have found something that we felt was appropriate. But again, we were sort of reassured that the rest of the language prohibits that.
I guess because here's my concern on a more general level. The city librarian has a contract with a distributor, and let's say he has no decision-making authority whatsoever in whether the library uses that distributor or what they get from that distributor. Still, the perception issue concerns me, and the possibility of undue influence just by virtue of him being the city librarian poses some concern to me. If that is a situation that you haven't encountered, that you're not currently trying to address by your amendments, I would be more comfortable with these proposals if it didn't exclude officers and the librarian himself from these restrictions.
I would wonder if we could propose, instead of having A, B, C, D, and E, if we could propose one statement working with ethics staff that addresses your concern and says addresses the officers of the commission and the city librarian.
What do my fellow
commissioners
think?
Sounds reasonable.
Well,
that's the only way that I could vote in favor.
Yeah. Well,
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was wondering if ethics staff would comment because I believe that there were certain restrictions on their behavior already, but the city librarian and the officers.
Yeah, the city librarian officers are also subject to the same rules that govern employees. Is that?
In my example where the city librarian is using a distributor on a side project, but he has no role whatsoever in whether the library uses that distributor, is he prohibited from doing that by any rules other than the SIA currently?
Generally speaking, the department head, the city librarian as a department head is where the buck stops. And really, if it is people under him make people the employees under him making decisions because he has a relationship with a distributor, it is the librarian, the city librarian, who would be in trouble. The city librarian could not
right,
be engaged
but,
in that.
But in my hypothetical, there's no obvious connection yeah. between the two. It's merely the appearance problem and the potential for abuse when you have the city librarian using a distributor
right.
the library uses.
Right, right.
I'm the hypothetical person. Imagine that the librarian contracts to do training for librarians in Houston, and that company is the trainer for less than $500. I hope that he has better use of his time. But and that company is considered for providing training in San Francisco to the library staff here. He does not make the decision about who to hire for the training, but they know that he does the training with that organization, even though it doesn't literally reach him to make the decision about who does the training. I think Commissioner Herr is saying that's the kind of situation that seems inappropriate but would not be covered by the existing conflicts rules.
I mean, even if it was over $500, it still arguably wouldn't be covered.
So
unless all decisions are imputed to the chief.
So I think what I'm hearing is that the commission is willing to consider removing the language for employees but leaving it in place for the officers, and that we should recast it and bring it back to you.
I think that's right, unless Ms. Singh is going to tell us that that situation is already covered by.
I think it's a good suggestion, something that we can try to work out. So it is something, I mean, really you're talking about undue influence by department head.
Yes. Right. Or appearance.
And we can distill them down to a single
statement
rather than four separate ones.
Right.
Okay. What were the revisions that had been considered? Was this one of them, among them?
This hadn't come up, honestly, the issue of officers and the city librarian. It was all about staff.
Yeah.
And when we work on it, I would like to include something in there that is, again, about purchasing materials for our collection, because if the city librarian wrote a book that was published by a major publishing house and it's appropriate for the collection, we would want to think about how to make sure that our collections could purchase it. Similarly, members of the commission, I mean, without undue influence, obviously, but because we collect broad and wide, we do purchase as much as we can.
Well, I would reiterate, you still have the AWD process to examine on a case-by-case, you know, if there was a compelling
circumstance. So my question, though, is who would sign the AWD for the if
the
it
person
was an
who
officer,
appoints the librarian.
So it would be the mayor for the library commission. Okay. Thank you.
Our next course is for the commission and Ms. Warren to work.
Which we will do.
Yes.
Yeah, I think this is a simple enough fix. I'm sure we'll have it for next month's agenda.
Thank you, Ms. Bourne, for your time and attention to the matter.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I understand we have no closed session today, although it was on the agenda.
Yeah, unfortunately, we had a drafting error in the agenda for the in an abundance of caution, we are going to either attempt to convey the information to you in a confidential memo or reschedule for next month.
So then the next item on the agenda is...
Yeah, excuse me. You should, even though we're not considering numbers four and five, agenda items four and five,
yes.
You probably should call them and just take public comment in the off chance there is some.
Okay. Agenda item number four, closed session. Any public comment? Number five, discussion and vote regarding closed session actions and deliberations. There were none, but any public comments? Number six, minutes of the commission's regular meeting of April 11th.
It's feeling a little heavy.
Commissioners, have any amendments?
Yes, and I apologize for not calling this one in, but On page 4, the name of the speaker is Mr. Zapala, not Zanala. I know that because he worked for my organization. That was the only one.
And any other changes to the draft proposed minutes? Public comment? Hearing none, is there a motion to approve the minutes?
I move that the minutes be approved with the change that Commissioner Steadley offered.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Agenda item number 7, policy priorities. Mr. St. Croix, would you like to introduce this agenda item?
Every year or so, the commission has an introspective discussion on what the major policy issues should be that the staff addressed for the coming year. Obviously, the staff's ongoing priorities are the day-to-day business of the office, with all kinds of people coming and going and tending to those needs. But the commission's job is to set policies for the staff to carry out, and we usually have several areas of concern. Sometimes, like education and communication with the general public, we've identified that as an ongoing concern. That should always be a priority, in that we have quality dealings with the people that we serve. In the case of others, like the campaign consultant ordinance, it had been a long time since we reviewed that. So that became a policy priority, and then we indeed did the work we needed to do to propose an updated version. So these are both project-oriented and performance-oriented. And then based on the prior discussions that we had, last year we had a couple of discussions on the October-November meetings about whether our education and outreach were adequate. And the commission seemed to come to the conclusion that we were doing well in those areas, that obviously there's always room for improvement. Let me make a more gentle statement in that direction. But that obviously there's other things we can be doing. So looking at what our immediate needs are, based on these discussions and some of the discussions we had at my annual review last summer, I put forward some ideas about what I think the stated priorities should be for the coming year or so for the commission in the memo.
Commissioners, any comments on Mr. St. Croix's memo and the policy priorities for the coming fiscal year?
Before I say, the most important thing I want to say is that I agree with the first priority. We have an incredible challenge in terms of the complexity of this year's race and the unprecedented scale of the campaign finance process management. And I've always been impressed by the constant daily reassessment, recalculation that goes on, and I can only imagine what this particular cycle will involve. So I think it is prudent, and in fact, had you said anything else at this moment, I would have wondered what you were thinking. So I really just want to say that I think that's very important priority, and that the shift of the other items in light of that makes sense.
I wholeheartedly agree with that, and I think this is number one, clearly number one, and one that will be the focus of how the performance of the commission is evaluated, and it's going to be a huge challenge, as you've identified, and I think putting in the resources necessary to make that happen effectively is critical.
I think that that's really what's at the top of our minds right now is this is a staff performance project, and if we do this as well as we plan to, I think that will be remembered. But it most assuredly will be remembered if you screw it up. So we don't want to do that. It's a little bit historic for us, and it may even, you know, based on Supreme Court decisions and such things, it could get messy. And we're going to be right in the front lines with this. So
what would need to be done before the decision comes out? Is there anything to kind of do in preparation for the unexpected?
Brain, you know, any ideas you might have, we're going to need to discuss, depending on what the outcomes are. And certainly we will have to react fairly quickly, because if we don't, if we just decide to, we're going to do our own thing, imagine all kinds of lawsuits will suddenly rain down. So without getting into too specific a discussion, we're already thinking, well, should we do this, should we do that?
Okay.
We'll have proposals.
Okay.
But we'll certainly be relying on the commission to help us fathom what the potential outcomes could be.
Okay, and will we have that closed session briefing next month on that?
We'll absolutely have it next month, unless I can find a way to perhaps do a confidential memo in lieu of that.
Okay.
The source of our legal advice on this issue is, remind me, please?
The mayor's.
Mm-hmm.
The Oakland City Attorney's Office. Who would have been here tonight had we not canceled the closed session? There's no point in bringing him otherwise.
I had a question about number three, the staff building, and sort of what you propose to help that process?
Mm-hmm. Well, when we get our budget news on June 1st, I'm confident not so much of good news, but a lack of bad news. And if that's the case, we've got a vacancy, and we have expected turnover coming. As always, we try as quickly as possible to integrate new people and get them up and running. It's been a real strain on the staff lately because of one person being gone, and unfortunately, we don't have the money. We have the permission, but not the money to bring someone else in temporarily. On the beginning of the fiscal year that we have the permission and the money, we need to get that position filled right away, and then when we do have anticipated turnover, to fill those as expeditiously as possible. The system, the way it works, is HR really doesn't let you look for help that you know you're going to need until the position is vacant. You can't do advance work. And it means that there's always a gap between those. The city likes that because it means attrition savings. But unfortunately, it always puts a temporary drain on the staff to fill in. So there's almost always a three-month gap between when one person leaves and their replacement starts. You know, so given that we have one vacancy now and we expect two in the coming year, less than the coming year, that's something we sort of have to work on and then get the current staff that's not going anywhere re-energized. It's just something we have to do. You know, it helps a lot. The staff hears a lot of good feedback from the commission. Whenever we have staffers here that aren't here every month, they're usually making some kind of presentation. And it really means a lot when you guys tell them how much you appreciate what they do. And you do. You always do. And they take that back. They take that back to the staff. And Mabel and I try very hard to tell people every now and then, pull them aside and say, we know how hard you work, and or you did an extra good job on that, or that sort of thing. And it's the only currency we have. We can't give bonuses, even if we had the money. There's very little we can do. So we try to be cheerleaders. You know, we try to have, we get them pizza sometimes, or, you know, we have staff encouragement parties. We had a little exercise not long ago where everybody was given 5 pieces of paper to write something positive about another staff member, Dan. We put them all in a box, and we all sat together and read them. It was a really nice thing to do. It was, Catherine's laughing, I think. Maybe she disagrees. Oh, that's right. You weren't there. Good things were said about Catherine as well, even though she wasn't there.
I hope you got your pieces.
I'm not a real touchy-feely kind of manager, but I thought it was a good exercise. And it was just sort of a, I think, nice for people to hear that other people appreciate them without, you know, because we sort of do that. We sort of appreciate each other without saying it all the time. So just having a cause to compliment each other. So we do what we can to keep morale built and strong. Knowing that there's going to be some turnover is always tough on everybody. It's going to be an exhausting year because the public finance people really run the mayoral campaign, but it's the campaign finance people that are up front. So they're the first lines when people come in for questions and for checks and that sort of thing. So, of course, the staff has always had, in my experience, a reputation for good public service, for being pleasant, helpful, engaged, knowledgeable, and we want to keep it that way. That's one of the things that I think I'm proudest of, and it's not my accomplishment, it's theirs. But I think that the way we attempt to keep morale up certainly helps them with the kind of energy that they need to keep that up.
Is there a staff retreat built into the budget? Is that part of anything?
No. No, we used to take several staff once a year to the ethics convention, which moves around the country, and we haven't had money for that in years. No, but we don't.
Okay. Is there?
You could do a motion to approve these as written, or to change them, or to add them, or edit them.
Okay. Well, we can take public comment first. Public comment on this matter?
David Pilpel, I am supportive. I think that these policy priorities make sense given the resources and constraints. A couple of quick comments, though. On the campaign consultant ordinance amendments, if the staff has not already done so, I think it would be helpful to have materials that objectively compare the proposed changes to the existing so that when and if it is placed on the ballot, you'll be able to say not just that it speaks for itself, but here are the changes, and so people can make an informed choice without you advocating for the changes, presumably. I think the staff building item that you talked about is incredibly important. There have been and continue to be, you know, staff changes, and that is an ongoing challenge. If I've not already done so, I appreciate Catherine and her good work because she has been. And clearly education and outreach is an ongoing and somewhat preventive measure that should be taken so that, you know, we do enforcement and we do fines, but we don't want to. We'd rather people comply and know what the laws are. That's, you know, better. And so keeping that on the list, I think, is a good idea. And clearly the mayoral program is pretty much front and center. I did have a separate suggestion for 2 specific bits of legislative work. I can talk about them now or under a separate agenda item that I was going to ask you to look at some point. They're not high priority for the world at large, but they're of concern to me, and I've raised them before at commission meetings, but it's been a while, so I wanted to call those to your attention. But otherwise, these priorities make sense, and I would encourage your support, therefore. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Is there a motion?
I move that we adopt these priorities for the coming year and commend the executive director for bringing them to us with such a wise set of priorities.
And Commissioner Ward seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? The next item on the agenda is the Executive Director's Report.
Okay.
Would you like to
highlight anything? Well, I had already mentioned my expectations for the budget. That was the major thing. I want to, at the risk of getting laughed at, apologize to the commissioners for the somewhat brevity, for the brevity of the meeting.
Commissioner Ward will forgive you.
We start out a lot of these months with really meaty agendas, and for one reason or another, things just sort of fall off. We were going to have a continuation of a probable cause hearing tonight that would have taken a long time, but had to grant a continuance for that. So we don't, and perhaps, I just don't want you to think, you know, we're not making the best use of your time when you have to come down here.
I think it just makes up for last month. That's all I can say.
All right. So we, and I'll try to let you know in advance, I think we do expect a longer meeting in June, but I'll let you know ahead of time. But that's the only thing I wanted to highlight today.
Public comment?
No.
Items for future meetings. Do the commissioners have anything to propose? Public comment?
Why don't I take this opportunity to
Absolutely.
Mention my two items? I know you were looking for them. David Pilpel again. There are two provisions in the conflict of interest laws, and I'm sorry that I can't cite whether it's 3.214, 16, 18, one of those, about disclosure. And you actually referenced that earlier when someone cannot participate in a decision. The way I understand it, that disclosure has to be made in public if it's in the context of a public meeting in the first instance when it comes up. But as I recall, it doesn't need to be repeated at subsequent meetings. And I further believe that the specifics around the reason for non-participation aren't required to be disclosed. My concern in this area is I expect city officers and department heads to participate in all matters that are before them unless they cannot or are properly recused. But as a member of the public, I would like to know the reason for that non-participation or recusal and not just have them take a walk or say, I can't participate. But if it's because they own property within 1,000 feet or they own stock in IBM or whatever the thing is, I would like that to be disclosed on the record at the meeting and at a subsequent meeting, so it's not just, oh, that person couldn't participate and we all know that. Well, yes, you may all know that, but the members of the public may not, and there's usually a different audience from meeting to meeting, and knowing that history may be important to the particular instance, and I think that's an area where you could require further disclosure. Not to conflict anybody else out, but to require that additional disclosure where it's not currently required. That was one area. The other is there's a prohibition on making contracts if you're a city officer, and that's defined and it's got exemptions and exclusions. One of those exemptions is for sitting on a nonprofit board of directors. I believe that it's important for people to serve the city. I think it's also important for people to serve on nonprofit boards. If you're an officer of the city and you serve on a nonprofit board that contracts with the city, I think that's a problem. And I think that's a problem even if it doesn't appear that there is a direct connection. And I could give examples of this. I think that when people make a choice to serve the city, they should be making a choice to not serve on a nonprofit board that contracts with the city for their term of service with the city. And it's that exemption for the nonprofits that I'm interested in you considering eliminating. I would be happy if you would at least ask the staff to look at these two items. I'm certainly not asking to make a decision on any of this right now, but I think these are things of concern and could take a little staff time to look at. And then I'd feel better. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great. And I didn't introduce myself properly to the new commissioner. Welcome. Thanks.
Any further public comment on matters appearing or not appearing on the agenda? Hearing none, is there a motion to adjourn the meeting?
I move that we adjourn.
I second that.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All
opposed? C wanted to stay.
So.